Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday. It's June 10th, 61 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning. And 61 is pretty much where we're going to be here today for that daytime high. We're pretty much at our daytime high in Park City, actually, because we're still waiting on that front to come through. It's actually in the Tooele Valley right now. So it'll be through most of the Wasatch Front and back over the next couple of hours. This will also be the windiest time frame that we'll see, because with the front coming through right along and behind it is where they will be very, very gusty from the west to northwest. So we are having that to anticipate over the next couple of hours here. So we'll end up mainly most of the day being in the upper 50s in Park City, with tonight's overnight low only in the upper 30s. So really a couple of nice days ahead, and those temperatures are going to feel awfully nice, because we'll go 73 tomorrow. Plenty of sunshine, too, over the next several days, and very, very dry. We're not expecting anything with this front with regards to precipitation or storms. It's just the initial wind. We're still under the red flag warning until 10 p.m., so keep that in mind as well. But then by the time we get to tomorrow, everything relaxes. We're going to have a nice day. And then by Saturday, we're going to be back into the 80s again, with plenty of sunshine again through the weekend. And then by the time we get to Sunday and Monday, we're in the upper 80s, approaching 90, with more cloud cover, mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies here heading into next week. But very, very hot temperatures here for the Wasatch Front, with record-breaking heat, as we'll be in the low 100s, and Park City will be in the 90s, low 90s for this time of year in Park City, with mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. And there is just not a drop of moisture here in the forecast over the next 7 days, which, speaking of which, the drought monitor came out this morning, as it does every Thursday morning, and it has upped the exceptional drought from 62% to 64% of the state. And this is all bad news, because we all know how bad the fires are right now, and we're only going to get worse.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Adam.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. Later on, Assistant General Manager and COO of the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, Darren Hess, talks about the drought and how it's impacting water sources here in Summit County. And finally, Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher with a monthly update. We'll take a look at some local news now. Utah Wildfire Info reporting the East Canyon Fire now 45% contained as of yesterday evening. The East Canyon Fire was started near East Canyon State Park in Morgan County midday Tuesday and has burned upwards of 1,000 acres before crews could even begin to contain the blaze. Summit County fire crews were monitoring the situation as winds have been pushing the blaze towards Summit County. Utah Wildfire announced late Tuesday that an investigation has determined that the fire was human-caused. A piece of heavy equipment is suspected to have struck a rock and ignited nearby vegetation. Highway 66 now open, but hiking trails in the area remain closed. Evacuations along the highway have also been lifted. A red flag warning, as Adam just mentioned, is in effect through the state until tonight at 10 o'clock. Also, the Pack Creek fire south of Moab has consumed the historic park, Pack Creek Ranch there. Reports to KPCW says, unfortunately, no time to evacuate the ranch, and they just let the horses there go. Well, a crowd of some 200 state, county, and local officials gathered under a large tent at the site of the new Mayflower Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Conference Hotel that is officially under construction and will be ready to welcome active and retired military members as soon as 2023. Holding traditional miner pickaxes, the CEO of the Extel Development Company, Utah Senate President, and Air Force Colonel ceremoniously posed for the groundbreaking of the MWR Conference Hotel. The finished hotel will be more than 640,000 square feet with 387 hotel rooms, 100 of those reserved for military personnel, along with 55 private residences and some 60,000 square feet of conference space. Given the military backbone of the hotel, the ceremony included a color guard presentation, the Pledge of Allegiance, the singing of both the national anthem and three verses of America the Beautiful. Utah Senator Stuart Adams welcomed the crowd, saying it was an exciting day that was a long time coming after finally getting a new military recreation complex built after the former Hill House at Snow Basin Resort was torn down to make way for the 2002 Winter Olympics. In 2007, MIDA, the Military Installation Development Authority, was created, which currently boasts of having the two largest economic development projects in the state, Hill Air Force Base and the Mayflower Mountain Resort, a $3 billion development. Senator Adams said after looking at as many as 30 different sites for the new facility, they settled on the property in Wasatch County.
We think we are in the best site in this, not only in this area, we think we've chosen the best site in the state and very likely the best site.
He also said after going through a rigorous request for proposal process to decide who would get to develop the property, MIDA selected Extel Development Company out of New York City.
And as we went through that process, and again, a very, very long process, we think we have, with Extel, the best developer in the entire world.
Founder and CEO of Extel, Gary Barnett, said he's proud to be developing the first mountain resort in this country in 40 years. 7 years ago, he started with a 40-acre piece of property off of US 40, and since then has amassed more than 7,000 acres. None of this, he says, would have happened without the support of Senators Adam and Jerry Stevenson, as well as the entire state of Utah.
My team in Utah, led by Kurt Krieg, has worked really hard to get us here, and I'm proud to have him represent Extel. Utah has been blessed with some of nature's most special land. We hope that through the grace of God and the help of everyone here, we'll be able to join hands and build another jewel for the people of Utah and for nature lovers and skiers from around the world.
Barnett also reported that the $20 million voluntary cleanup of the old mining property is almost done and that they continue to meet with Deer Valley Resort to see if they can come to terms with a partnership deal. Wasatch County Councilmember Steve Farrell, the only elected representative from Wasatch County on the MIDA board, said Barnett has done more than any of them imagined.
Mr. Barnett's vision for this area far surpasses the original vision.
Colonel Janice Carroll, commander of the 75th Air Base Wing at Hill Air Force Base, said once built, the MWR will be a welcome respite for military men and women.
This represents for the men and women, military and their families, just a key cornerstone of a facility, military morale, welfare, and recreation facility that they can come to, whether they come to ski or whether they're returning from a deployment. It is an amazing opportunity that we can now enjoy in Utah. So I'm just very proud to be a part of history in the making.
Jacobson Construction, the general contractor, expects to complete construction of the MWR Conference Hotel in 30 months, with the grand opening slated for December 2023. The hotel construction is expected to cost about $390 million. The Summit County Council put in a marathon session yesterday, the open meeting alone running for 6 hours. On the phone with a recap, I have Councilmember Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Leslie.
So after months of discussion, County Council adopting the neighborhood mixed-use zone, there was one dissenting vote from Roger Armstrong. At your suggestion, the zone provides that affordable housing obligation will be increased from 20% to 50%. How come?
Well, there's two components to it. There is, if you're doing residential, you have to increase the amount you were going to do by now 50%. And then on the commercial side, you have to offset the additional workers that your development would create. And you have to offset at least 50% with this new verbiage. And I just felt like that in order to grant, I felt like we need more affordable housing. And in order to allow for this clustered mixed-use nodal development to occur, that it needs to have a large affordable housing component. It allows for multifamily, which is a very, very hot commodity in this market and nearly any market, and it needed to be counterbalanced by, in my judgment, and I think in the majority of the councils, and really I think in Roger's judgment as well, although he had some other reservations, there needed to be this counterbalance.
So just to clarify, if project is built under the mixed-use zone and they build 100 units, does that mean that 50 of them have to be affordable, or does this allow the developer to build 100 market units as well as 50 affordable units for a total of 150?
The latter, but see, the thing about this zone is it doesn't have specified density, just like the community commercial. So you can build however many units that you can fit on the site, meeting the open space requirements, the setbacks, the height limitations, and so forth. So just as you pointed out in your example, you have 100 units, now you have to add 50 more. 50, 150th is a third of the project. 33% of the residential units that would be built on, in that project would be affordable, one third.
So what's considered affordable in your mind?
Well, then you have to go back to Chapter 5 of our code, and it talks about workforce equivalents, and it provides a lot of definition on that, and I don't have it memorized. But there's already a framework for determining the types of units and what counts and all of that in Chapter 5 of our code. So the change that we made modifies a 20% requirement, taking it to 50% in Chapter 5.
So explain how this then relates to Section 2.3 of the Development Code, that if a developer supplies this 50% affordable housing, does this supply then the compelling countervailing benefit that justifies an increase in density?
Well, the NMU zone is a new zone that arguably is an up zone, which would fly in the face of 2.3. And so the whole decision as to whether something gets zoned to NMU will have to satisfy 2.3.
So
in other words, well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just curious, I mean, given these sort of restrictions here, I mean, do you feel like you've got willing developers ready to go here? Or would anybody even want to do this?
Well, the NMU is only applicable in areas that are shown on our general plan as mixed use. So there's a finite number of those. And the original application for us to consider creating an NMU was instigated by a developer over in Silver Creek Village. It is a pretty tall standard, but I think, you know, it's not. First of all, multifamily is not a required, and for a mixed use, there have to be three different uses. Nothing says that they have to build residential. Residential, obviously, is the sweet spot in the market where most developers would gravitate. But I think that only time will tell, but it is a pretty flexible zone. Its limitation, its use will be limited to first those areas that are zoned or that are on the general plan show mixed use, and secondly, convincing the council that it's the right thing to rezone.
Okay, let's see, the council also adopted the master plan development process as part of this, also adopting an amendment to the accessory dwelling TZO, which will exempt small applications of 5,000 square feet and less. Again, a dissenting vote from council member Roger Armstrong. Why did you favor this?
Well, We passed a temporary zoning, basically a moratorium on accessory buildings that wasn't going to expire until the 10th of September, but it isn't going to expire. And it was a shotgun approach, and we're working on a rewrite of that accessory building ordinance. But there were some unintended consequences where relatively small projects that had been in various stages of the pipeline but hadn't been vested were basically being prohibited from moving forward. And so we thought, at least the majority of us thought, that 5,000 feet and below is a threshold that's not going to cause any harm, and it will do a lot of good to those who want to take advantage of this building season and build a relatively modest building. It was the upper end where we've had more contention, but not at the 5,000 square foot level.
All right. So the TZO then will expire in early September as opposed to being extended from 6 months from yesterday?
Correct. The TZO, we amended the previous TZO to exempt from its reach 5,000 and smaller square feet.
Okay. It sounds like the council is planning a retreat to discuss items like the American Rescue Plan and affordable housing. Do you have any particular wish list items for the American Rescue Plan money?
I have hoped that we would find some legacy projects on which to spend it, that it wouldn't just get absorbed in what I'll call normal operations. And I think that's County Manager Tom Fisher's goal, too. We haven't really discussed it as a council. But I don't have any one particular item I'd point to and say, yes, we ought to fund this. But I hope that it would be some legacy things, because this is one-time money and, it's significant money. We received or will receive a total of almost $8.2 million. And I know the manager has some aspirations of spending maybe 20 to 25% of it on some things that maybe wouldn't have that lasting legacy, but the balance I'd like to see spent that way.
So what do you mean by lasting legacy? I mean, are we talking like a bridge or something?
Well, yeah, some piece of infrastructure that would be here forever or virtually, and that would make a difference that we've maybe had on a wish list but haven't been able to afford, or something that would move a needle that we've been trying to jiggle for a long time and haven't been able to. I don't know what that exactly would look like, but I think it'd be good to brainstorm around that.
Okay. Let's see, the council next week scheduled to receive a budget amendment which would unfreeze some staff positions and add some positions such as a public lands manager and a multimedia coordinator. Also a new proposal to add a building inspector to be shared with Francis City. The estimated cost, not including the building inspector, over $500,000. Council Member Armstrong suggested that with this new spending plus the COLAs and merit increases, we may end up talking about a tax increase. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think it's adding up to a fair amount. I know that the council made a decision a few years ago that we're not going to, sort of coast along and then every 30 years have a major tax increase. We set a policy that I think every 5 years we're going to review our taxing structure and consider going through truth in taxation in small bites instead of postponing, and then having a big bite. But I, like Roger, I'd like to see the totality of these salary administrative adjustments and the new hires and see what the total picture looks like. But it is adding up to quite a bit of money.
All right. So this multimedia coordinator, is this somebody that's just dealing with social media? Or are we talking about this is the person that's going to help us ward off cyber attacks?
I think it's to do both. I think it's to buttress our IT department. And, we're now doing this hybrid council meeting where haven't abandoned the silver lining to the pandemic, which is that we've learned to work remotely. We're now trying to adapt a way forward that includes in-person and virtual meetings. We had great turnout at our virtual meetings, and we don't want to cause that to come to an end, but we also want to have an anchor location and have live in-person meetings. So there's that element. And the cybersecurity piece is one that you can't take for granted. And it's ubiquitous, the attacks that ne'er-do-well perpetrators are trying to foist on us and on lots of people. And as was stated, Mountain Regional had a ransomware attack on some subset of its administrative computers. Didn't affect service or security or water quality, but they lost a couple of years' data potentially. More like, I assume, you know, performance records of how their system works, but it's not something to be taken lightly.
And then moving on to the affordable housing presentation, the council got a fire hose of information from Economic Development Director Jeff Jones on the topic. A lot of discussion about what direction to give to staff. But Chris, a lot of the time it sounded like you were going through an identity crisis. I mean, what's Summit County? Who are we? And even a minute or two, there was some talk about, do we want to be another Sandy City, something that KPCW addressed about 25 years ago. The answer then was no. So I guess we've put four questions to Jeff. One, we know about 39% of our workforce is living in Summit County. Is that good, bad, or in between?
Yeah, it doesn't seem ideal. I mean, it seems like the trajectory is that the median home price is going to continue to rise, that there will be more and more jobs created here, if you believe Jeff's trend lines. And I think the jobs were being created in the past at a little over 2% a year, maybe it was 4% a year, and in the future he's projecting 2% a year. And so you have these trend lines that are diverging. You have the housing getting real expensive and the percent that can afford it pulling away, and it gets to, you know, are we just a kind of a rich retirement community where everybody migrates into work, or are we a full-fledged, you know, community that has the full socioeconomic spectrum that lives here and works here? And those are really important questions on what we want to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that 39% again, is that a good number, or should we aim for higher?
Well, if you remember from his presentation, it used to be around 50% and we've slid 10 or 12%. I think it should be higher. I think it's demonstrative of, it's just one little data point that indicates that we really have a lack of affordable housing.
All right. And then there was also some concern about what we do about households who are paying more than 30% of their income, up to like 50%. I mean, can we do anything for them?
Well, those are called burdened households. And the way we do something about them, one way is to create more product that would fit within that 30% of their income category.
Well, does that then lead into the idea of addressing the problem by perhaps zoning more land or asking cities and employers to provide their fair share?
Well, I think it's probably all of the above. As an example, the NMU going from 20 to 50%, will require, if somebody wants to play in that arena, that they create a lot more affordable housing. And that would fit into the category, your zoning category. The cities need to do their part, and so do the employers. One of Roger's comments was that, well, we live within, you know, the average commute time in America is 27 minutes, and we live within 20 minutes, or, you know, within that length of time from Salt Lake City and Wasatch County, and maybe it all, you know, maybe we don't need to worry about it. maybe it's not so bad if they commute in, but and that's just one factor, and I'm oversimplifying it, but it's a multifaceted problem.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a great one.
Well, as the state's drought situation continues to worsen, communities across the state starting to implement more severe water restrictions. On the phone to tell us what that means for the water being provided by the Weaver Basin Water Conservancy District, I have Assistant General Manager and COO Darren Hess. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. So maybe start by telling us which water sources that the Weaver Basin actually manages. I mean, of course, the headwaters of your namesake start here in Summit County.
Yes, yes. So we have seven large reservoirs, six of which are, you know, along the Wasatch Front, behind the Wasatch Front. And so those include Rockport Reservoir, Smith and Morehouse, East Canyon, Lost Creek. And then on the Ogden side, we also manage Causey, and then the top half of Pineview Reservoir. And then Willard Bay is our large reservoir at the bottom of the system. So, yeah, we have a lot of infrastructure to manage along the Wasatch Front as well, in addition to the Wasatch Back. So we serve about 700,000 individuals along the Wasatch Front and Wasatch Back with water.
Okay. And again, that water comes to Park City as well as several county water agencies, Gargosa, the High Valley Water Company, Mountain Regional, Summit Water, and the cities also of Colville and Oakley. How is it? I mean, is the water paid for through our property taxes? I know on my tax bill, there's a line item for the Weaver Basin Water Conservancy District.
Yes. So, I mean, we are mainly a wholesale water provider to the Snyderville Basin, Park City area. So, as you mentioned, we do provide water to the large retailers in that area, Mountain Regional, Summit Water, Park City. And so, you know, obviously we just charge for the water that we deliver to them, but then there is an ad valorem tax that is on the county taxes, and that pays for the flood control responsibilities that Weaver Basin has, recreation for, you know, the individuals in the area, and then also just the overall infrastructure that was built initially to be able to provide water in a situation like we're in now, where we have a drought, because this year, obviously, well, this year we just didn't have any runoff to speak of. In a typical year, Weaver Basin would store 220,000 acre feet of water, and an acre foot of water is basically a football field a foot deep. So that gives you an idea of how much water that is. We would normally store 220,000. This year, we stored about 7,000. So 3% of what we would normally store. There just wasn't any runoff this year. That's really the problem with this year. And it's an historic year, one that we really haven't seen probably for about 75 years on the main stem of the Weaver. It is that bad this year.
Wow. So what actions, if any, are you taking that would impact us here in Summit County?
So in Summit County, we are asking that if individuals have municipal water that go to their outdoor systems, water their lawns and gardens, we are asking them to cut back at least 20%, and actually no more than two times of watering per week right now, you know, starting this week. We just can't afford, and people just don't understand how much water they deliver to their outdoor landscapes. When individuals water one time through one irrigation cycle of their sprinkler system, they water about 3,000 to 4,000 gallons. And that's over half the water they use indoors for a full month. And so when people understand how much water they're putting on their landscapes, if we can reduce that watering one time a week and go down to twice a week, you can see how that savings adds up. That's 12,000 to 16,000 gallons a month per household that we would save.
So with only a third of the water that you actually have, I mean, is that enough to get you through the summer to your, you know, to fulfill your obligations to those downstream water users?
Well, for the individual user, we are getting a lot of questions like, is that enough water for my landscape? You know, will my landscape do fine? And your landscape is not going to thrive on a third of the, you know, two thirds of the water it normally receives. But it will be fine. You'll have Kentucky bluegrass is actually quite resilient to drought. It will turn a straw colored or a brown color, and it's just going into dormancy. But once the precip returns and temperatures decrease, it will come out of that dormancy and should be fine. You want to continue to water it because you want to keep the crown of the plant alive. And typically 1 inch of water per month will keep that crown alive. And we just want to make sure that we do that. And we're allowing one watering waters about a half inch of water. And so 20 minute sprays, 40 minute rotors, that's one watering. And so that will definitely keep the plant alive. It won't be thriving, but it'll survive just fine.
Yeah. I mean, you sound pretty optimistic that precipitation will return and temperatures will drop. But, you know, as we know, that we're not even into summer yet.
No, I'm talking fall time. It's going to be a summer where, you know, the landscapes, definitely water your trees and shrubs, you know, make sure that you water those, but the grass is quite resilient, but it is going to be a difficult summer for everybody involved just because we don't have the water that we would typically have. And like we said, this is an historic year. We all need to chip in and do our part to make sure, you know, we can get through it and make these our supplies last as long as we can. I mean, there's a lot of water districts that will flat just run out of water along the Wasatch Front just because, you know, they won't have additional water in storage. And the reason is because we've gone on storage so early this year on the river systems because we just didn't have the natural flow in the river that we typically see.
Yeah. Weber Basin, I read, is also instituting what it is calling a three strikes, you're out rule. What's this?
Yeah, so this is enforcement. As Weber Basin, as we go around and just monitor the situation, and we're asking folks not to water between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., not during the hottest hours of the day, and obviously no more than twice per week. But as we see infractions to those rules that we've instituted, we will be giving educational warnings, door hangers, two of those, an orange hanger and then a red hanger. And then if we've educated you, talked with you twice, and we still have issues or problems, infractions, then, you know, we will be forced to shut the system off. But we don't want to get to that point. We want to educate and help people understand the seriousness of the drought this year.
All right. And as you mentioned, reservoirs are at some of their lowest levels that they've ever been. I mean, even since they may have been filled. As you mentioned, Rockport is one of the local reservoirs here, used as a pretty big recreation area. Has that been impacted at all as a result of just the low levels?
Yes, yeah, it will definitely be impacted. You know, the boat ramps obviously only go so far down into the water, and at some point, I'm sure the state parks will likely shut that down. Drive by Rockport Reservoir and take a look right now. It's about 50% full, or and it's dropping every day. And so typically we're at our highest point in terms of storage on June 1st, and that highest point was about 55%, and it continues to drop. So yes, unfortunately, recreation will be impacted, and at some point throughout the summer, I'm sure the state parks will probably shut down recreation there just because you can't get a boat on the water.
Yeah, so how low can you let that go? In terms of,
yeah. So we have a minimum conservation pool that we have in Rockport Reservoir, and so we have to keep a certain volume. I can't recall exact. It's about probably 4,000, 5,000 acre feet that we have to keep in the reservoir just for wildlife. We don't want to kill the fish. And so there will be a small pool there that we will have to leave and want to leave for wildlife purposes. Hopefully we don't get to that threshold, but it's entirely possible this year. But yes, it will be very small by the end of the summer.
Yeah. And given that droughts don't typically last just a single year, what are the forecasts for the future? I mean, I'm sure you're looking ahead.
Yes, and that's part of the reason for the restrictions and why we're trying to do this. If we have another year like, this one's historic. I mean, to have 2020 be as dry as it was and have the soil moistures plummet like they did, again, on the main stem of the Weber, this is an historic year. We sure hope we don't have something that repeats itself, but if it does, we are, we do have these restrictions in place. And we want to make sure that we at least preserve a municipal and industrial component of the water next year for indoor drinking water. We want to make sure we preserve that storage in our reservoirs so we have that for next year. But, irrigation could be cut drastically next year if we don't see changes.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell our listeners, Darren?
We just appreciate everybody's help this year in terms of doing what they can. Really, it's the outdoor watering that we're talking about. Please do everything you can to try to limit the outdoor watering, and I think we'll be fine.
All right. Darren Hess is the Assistant General Manager and COO of the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District. Sure, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joining me now in the studio, Emily Fisher, Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about just this week. You had your fundraiser, the annual golf tournament, I guess skipping a year, but coming back.
Yeah, we actually were able to hold it last year, but we held it in September, and it was a smaller, socially distanced event. And so this year, we're excited to get back to a full-scale event. We had just under 100 golfers at Victory Ranch, and this is the fifth year in a row we've held the event at Victory Ranch. They're just a great partner, and it's always a wonderful day out there. We also had a new sponsor come on board, Keller Williams Park City, which our offices are now in their building. So it was really fun to partner with the people that we see in the hallways day in and day out and be able to run that with their support. So that was great. We also have, our beverage sponsors, which is important for a golf tournament, Roja Brewing Project and Alpine Distilling. And then we had great prizes and support always from Vail Epic Promise, Jan's, Rosignol, and Stein Collection.
All right. So did you raise the money you were hoping for?
We did. We had a really successful day, and that event is fundraising just for YSA and our programming, so it's an important event for us, and really excited that we hit our budget targets.
Okay. And as we reported earlier this week, Youth Sports Alliance was selected as a finalist for the High Impact Grant from the Women's Giving Fund from the Park City Community Foundation. This is not your first time being a finalist, though?
Correct. We were a finalist, I believe, in 2017 and 2019 as well. So just honored that the Park City Community Foundation and the Women's Giving Fund selected us as a finalist. It's always great to just be able to tell our story to a broader group of people, and just honored to be finalists along with Jewish Family Services and Eats Park City, both awesome organizations in town.
Yeah, I mean, it's significant. I mean, what would you do with usually about 30 grand is what it is.
Yeah, it's actually now up to 40,000, which is a significant amount of money for us. And so what we want to do, what our grant proposal is all about, is expanding our programming so the whole entire county can benefit from our program. We have dug into the research on the east side of the county and some of our underserved populations. When you look at the obesity rates, they are actually 30% higher than we are in Park City. And so we know that active kids become active adults. And so we want to provide as many programs as we can so we can provide that spark to kids to find something so they can be active for life. Again, we just know that when kids are active, they do better in school, they have better health. health outcomes, but on mental health outcomes. So we are hoping to use that money to expand our program to North Summit School District, South Summit School District, and Wileman School of Discovery. We've done some pilot programs in South Summit, and we would love to expand those programs to have greater offerings. In South Summit, their after-school options are really, really limited. So the kids oftentimes on those early release days are just going home. They're unsupervised and they're on their screens. So that's what our proposal is all about. And you can learn more about our proposal at parkcitycf.org. That's the Park City Community Foundation, where all three grant proposals and our videos are.
All right, let's see. July 6th is when you find out, and perhaps third time is a charm.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping, third time is a charm. But if there are any Women's Giving Fund members out there, I would just encourage them to vote. I think it's really important, and it's a really impactful way that we can benefit the women and children of Summit County.
All right, and then finally, we've got a go for Jan's Winter Welcome.
Yes, we're very excited. Jan's Winter Welcome will be October 23rd this year, again at the Stein Erickson Lodge. Excited to have that event back in person. Last year, we couldn't hold that event, but we were able to raise the same amount of money through awesome community support, and we are able to give $200,000 back to those seven local sport clubs. So we're excited to have that event again in person, and tickets will go on sale late July. And again, that event is to benefit the seven local winter sport clubs that we work with, our Stein Erickson Endowment, and our programs at YSA.
So it's usually a packed crowd. Is it going to be able to be as big as it has been?
Well, you know, I think we are meeting with Stein's here in the next week to see what exactly we're going to do with that event. We'll probably kick that can down the road just a little bit. But, of course, we will follow all of the state and local protocols for events, but I think we're just going to wait a little bit and see how many tickets we can actually sell.
Okay. Anything else?
I think that's it. I just, again, would encourage any Women's Giving Fund members out there to make sure that you vote, because there's some great projects out there, and this is why we're all a part of the Women's Giving Fund, and we can definitely make a difference.
Okay. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
Emily Fisher is the Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the threat of cyber attacks is real. Summit County discovered that recently. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher gave a brief report Wednesday to the County Council, saying that the Mountain Regional Water District had sustained some electronic assaults in recent weeks.
It was a small malware incident against a few of their computers in the office. It had no effect on any operation or any safety situation with water delivery or treatment of water.
He said the attack was directed at their office activities.
And the result of it was that they lost a couple years worth of data related to that, which they believe they're going to be able to recover, or that the state believes that they're going to be able to recover.
Fisher and the county staff are asking for some personnel additions to the budget, including a position for a multimedia coordinator. The recent cyber attack is one reason for the request.
It's real that this stuff can happen, and it can happen to public entities and public entities close to us. So it's just another reason why we need to, I'm not touting our request for an IT person, but we need to have the right expertise and the right budget around these types of things, because they're becoming real. We're already insured against that type of activity, but it doesn't make it better when it happens to have insurance.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Heber grieves. Friends remember the teens and the mother who were killed in Monday's crash on Highway 189. KPCW's Michelle Deininger has more.
In a town Heber's size, almost everyone knows each other, and a tragedy striking one family affects everyone. But even by small town standards, the crash on Highway 189 late Monday afternoon was shocking. Two of the victims, 2021 Wasatch High School graduates Peyton Caldwell and Emma Call, died after being hit by a Jeep driven by Amy Nelson, whose daughter is a current Wasatch High student. Nelson was also killed. Nelson's Jeep was sent careening into the teenager's car after it was rear-ended by a Ford truck. Investigators haven't yet determined what caused the accident. Hundreds of residents turned out for a candlelight vigil remembering all three victims Tuesday night. The vigil began at an intersection near Peyton's house, with mourners walking first to Peyton's, next to the Nelson home, and then to Emma's house. All lived near each other. Tiffany Hall, a lifelong friend of Peyton's, called the vigil really good and really sad.
Pretty much the whole senior class plus other siblings and the underage, like juniors and sophomores, there was hundreds of people that showed up to it. The streets, like cops had to block off streets to how many people there were. Peyton's and Emma's closest friends were over on a grass area. They knew them really well, and then whoever wanted to go up and talk did. I got up there. It was obvious, very emotional, and everyone was just bawling their eyes out.
Tiffany called Peyton humble, kind, and someone everyone wanted to be friends with. Peyton, she said, had been planning to study something related to medicine or psychology in college at Southern Utah University. Emma was headed to Snow College. Maddie Farrell, who was friends with Emma and Peyton, is close to Peyton's younger twin sisters and said she grew up considering Peyton her own older sister. It was Peyton who introduced her to Emma, who Maddie said became a friend as well. Maddie remembered Emma.
You could really tell that there was something special about her. She would walk into a room and just instantly make everyone smile. Like, I don't think you could ever be sad around her. A lot of people would always say that she was the color yellow. I think that's really true. If you got to know her, even just by like looking at a picture of her, you could tell. She was full of energy, and it was just like, she would make it her goal not to make you sad.
As the community starts processing its shock and grief, the girls said many are taking comfort in their faith and their knowledge that God has a plan.
The church groups came and just gave some very nice words, and I heard that they gave blessings to the families, which I thought was really cool. And we had some people that weren't able to show up, but they still called in or texted and gave their words of comfort and advice. It's so sad to see them go, but for their family's belief points, it was their time to join with their Heavenly Father again. And we're so grateful that they were able to make an impact on their life and our life. They were great people, and I'm glad I got to know them.
Anyone who would like to support the victims' families can visit a GoFundMe page the Farrell family set up. It's titled, In Memory of Peyton Caldwell and Emma Call. Michelle Deininger, KPCW News.
Well, just weeks after passing a Second Amendment Sanctuary County Ordinance, the Wasatch County Council passed Resolution 21-04 declaring June Diversity and Inclusion Month. KPCW's Carolyn Murray highlights a lively discussion ending with seven council members voting yes and one abstention.
Wasatch County Council member Danny Good introduced the inclusion ordinance, citing the recent adoption of Mental Health Months and First Responder Awareness Months. He deliberately wanted to align with June and acknowledge that Governor Cox declared June Pride Month in Utah.
The reason that I didn't go specifically towards Pride is because I knew that it would probably fail. I knew that there are some people that, well, you can see what's happening here. So instead of going into it very much in depth, I would just say that I think that it would be good for us. I think it would be good for everyone for us to support this resolution. It would prove without any doubt to me and to others, if it's needed, that we are in support of everyone in our community.
Good said it is critical to show everyone living in Wasatch County that they are supported.
You know, let's go back to First Responders Month. Let's just lay it out. I know personally, and some of you might, that many of those first responders are part of the LGBT community, and we celebrate them as first responders. We also passed Mental Health Awareness Month. Now, can you imagine living in this community, being a gay or trans or one of the people in the LGBT community, and you're a first responder, and we pass Mental Health Awareness Month, but we don't want to recognize you for who you are. We want you to stay in the closet.
Councilmember Kendall Crittenden asked for a motion to amend the ordinance and cited including it in July when the community celebrates Independence Day and Pioneer Day. He was concerned it was too focused on one group.
Well, and I guess that's my problem. We keep coming back to one group to argue why we should do it when the resolution itself says that very thing, that we recognize and respect and appreciate and everybody. Regardless of of whatever. But we want to keep coming back to you know, anyway.
Good said it would not be suitable for the county to lump the inclusion and diversity resolution into July's celebrations.
It does nothing for the county. It does nothing for the council. It does nothing for our community.
How does it not do the same thing for the community in July as it does in June?
Because you know very well, as I said in last week when I brought it up, that I wanted it to be part of June because I think that inclusion as part of June is where we should be going. I think it's important for the reasons that we all understand. And, you know, I understand that this is going to be difficult in Wasatch County, but I don't think it should be that hard. I think that this should be something that we could do.
Crittenden's amendment did not receive a second, so was not considered in a vote. The Wasatch County resolution declaring June Diversity and Inclusion Month passed unanimously in the County Council with one abstention. You can find a link to the meeting on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.